First of all, thanks very much to Rick McKinney and to my sister-in-law, Tina, and to Ron, and to all of you. We will do this together. So thank you, everyone, for being here. People often, people especially who are interested in Zen, often think that I'm very fortunate because I was able 20 years ago to go to Japan and live and train in a monastery, and have been doing that for the last 20 years. I was also very lucky to even get a job teaching at a Zen university. I don't know if you're familiar, but there actually are, just like this is a Catholic college in Japan, there are Buddhist, and there is one Rinzai Zen University. And I am very, very fortunate, very, very blessed. But over the years, I've come also to really seriously and sincerely feel that you here who do not go to Japan, who stay on your own home ground, so to speak, and struggle there, are really blessed and fortunate as well, maybe even more courageous than I am. In a sense, I was desperate 20 years ago. I had no other choice. That's why I went and did what I did. But then again, maybe I was just too lazy to do it here. I must tell a brief story. Maybe some of you have already heard, so you don't get any illusions about who I am. I think it was about 2 years ago when Dr. Albert Mickey Stunkler first asked me to give a little talk for, I think it was the Wednesday evening Haverford group of the PBA, the Philadelphia Buddhist Association. And although I'm from Philadelphia, I left 20 years ago, so I had not been connected with the Philadelphia Buddhist Association. I didn't really know anyone. I came to know Dr. Stunkard over the years. He visited me in Japan and whatnot. But when I was asked to give a talk, it was very moving to me because this is my hometown. I grew up, you know, down the street, Germantown, Crusham and Durham, you know, maybe a bit of a long but a bicycle ride from here. So it means very much. It's a very precious opportunity for me to be here. And that first talk 2 years ago, one of the things I was asked to do was to talk a little bit about my life, why I grew up, how I grew up, why I went to Japan, why I left Philadelphia and did the crazy things I did. And I tried to do that very frankly, to talk about as a young man, the struggle that I went through. And because I was talking about that, I usually don't talk about that kind of stuff. And my mother, who's in her late 80s, said, "I want to go and hear Jeff talk about that. You know, I know he went to Japan 20 years ago, but I sure as heck don't understand why." I have a twin sister. So she said, "Well, Mom, I'll take you. I want to hear too." So they came, and some of my friends came, some who are here tonight. And the talk went, I thought, very well received. And one of the results of that is, of course, this evening, this weekend. But you have to watch what you do in your hometown, because I thought I pretty much unloaded myself and told them very frankly about who I was and what I did. But just as that wonderful evening was coming to an end, and we were getting ready and we were talking about plans for maybe doing something like this eventually, I look over in the corner of the room, and my mother, who's in her late 80s, is sitting over there intensely speaking with one of the senior members of the Philadelphia Buddhist Association. And just at the moment that I happen to listen, because it's time to go home, you know, what she's saying, "Oh yes, whenever the police came to our house, it was usually about little Jeffy. Mom, time to go." But in a way, I was grateful even for that, for them to know that, although I didn't tell them. Speaking of which, we have two of my more important teachers with us tonight. Susako, that's my wife, and my 12-year-old son, Evan. So, And Monique is Ron Sinica's wife to their little baby, Tom. Anyway, the story doesn't really have a whole lot to do with Zen Buddhism, but it's not completely irrelevant. Let me try to speak very frankly and very briefly about what Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, but really Buddhism is all about. I don't see any reason to limit it to Zen. I will try to go deep enough to satisfy even the most experienced soul, but also try to go slowly enough so that those of you who aren't familiar with Buddhism, with the jargon, whatever, can follow. If I say something you don't understand, don't hesitate to speak up. What is Buddhism really all about, very simply? One way we can look at that is with the life of Shakyamuni, the founder of Buddhism. He lived about 2,500 years ago. The stories that we have about him are largely legendary. We don't know so much actual fact, but the legends themselves tell us a lot. For example, probably most of you already know the basic outline of Shakyamuni's life, that he was brought up as a very wealthy kind of a prince at that time, and he lived a very full life, and he did not come to know any sadness or suffering. He married and had a beautiful child. But at one point in his early life, they say around his late 20s, he came into contact with illness, aging, and death. And he realized that these kinds of problems are problems that there was nothing he could do to get around it. We get ill sometimes. We can never be in perfect health. We're never free completely from illness, or at least the possibility of being ill. Health itself is a relative state. Aging, you know, even with the genome project, we're still going to get old. We may get old a little better, but we're still going to age, and we still will eventually pass away. These are inevitable. These are basic religious questions that, of course, any genuine religion has to deal with. Well, Shakyamuni lived in such a rich and wealthy life that he didn't have anything to go back on. So when he was struck with the full force of these questions, and again, this is a legend, so how could he live 28 years and never come into contact with illness, aging, or death? It's a bit unrealistic. But the existential point of the story, I think, is clear. It brings the drama more clearly into perspective. Anyway, as a result of facing these problems and realizing that in his life of abundance, having everything, he, in effect, had nothing, because there was nothing he could do to resolve this illness, aging, and death that now plagued him. And again, it wasn't just for him, but for all beings, or for all humankind. How can we get free from, be liberated from this problem? So, as you probably know, he went off and he struggled, and he went through great ascetic practices. He studied with leading meditation teachers of his time. He mastered the art of meditation, became the equal of the teacher that he was with. But he realized that even if he went into a meditative state and he was not aware of illness, aging, or death, as soon as he came out of that state, it was the same old thing. So as the story, the legend, and the sutras go, he immediately left that teacher because it was unsatisfactory. It did not solve the problem. He supposedly went to another teacher. The same kind of thing happened. Eventually, he went on his own, and then he met with five other ascetics, five other people who were undergoing austerities, religious austerities, to try to liberate themselves. This is 2,500 years ago in India. What happened was Shakyamuni, according to the legends, practiced so hard that he realized his navel, his belly button, was touching his backbone. from not eating, from fasting. And he realized that he was losing his powers of concentration. He was becoming weak. He was dying. But he wasn't getting liberated. There was something wrong with the approach he was taking, as extreme as it was. And then, according to some sutras, it says he recalled the time as a child, a small child, when he was sitting under a rose apple tree, and it was a very pleasant breeze. And he just spontaneously entered a kind of samadhi, or concentrated meditation state. He wasn't intending. It was perfectly a kind of a natural mystical experience. And he felt a certain oneness. And it wasn't a sensuous thing. He realized it wasn't just a sensuous experience. It was something that transcended the senses. And yet it was pleasing. Maybe here there's a bit of an insight. Maybe this just going on and not eating and trying to focus for hours after hours, I'm going to die. I'm not going to get enlightened. So he realized, according to the legend, that he has to take what is now, of course, called the middle way. So he took some nourishment. He figured, I have to get my body back in strength to really get to the bottom of this. When the other five ascetics that he was training with, that he was practicing with, saw him do this, they said, he's chickened down, couldn't handle it. Right? He's indulging. So they decided, if we see him again, we will allow him to sit with us, but he will not be a part of our community. He chickened out, so to speak. But Shakyamuni did what he thought he must do. He got his strength back, and then, as you may know, he sat under the Bodhi tree, and he sat through himself, and he realized himself. What we now say is he awakened. That's what Buddha means. Buddha means an awakened one. Not the awakened one, an awakened one. All of us are Buddha. It doesn't mean the awakened one 2,500 years ago. It means you awakened. Out of compassion, he decided to share this awakening with other people. It's a bit of a long story and I won't go into it. He decided to go to his teachers that he had left, but he found out that they had already passed away. So eventually, he went back to those five ascetics. And those five ascetics, when they first saw him, they said, oh, here comes Shakyamuni. Well, we'll allow him to sit down, but he's not one of us, because remember, he was indulging. He chickened out. But somehow, when he came, he was different than when he left. And so, without thinking, they did make the bow and let him sit down. And as you all know, he then supposedly spoke to them. This is what's called the first sermon, the first turning of the Dharma wheel. The first turning of the wheel is a metaphor, kind of like a military caravan that crushes all. Of course, here it's a religious metaphor, so all evil and all ignorance are being crushed with this turning of the wheel of Dharma, or the wheel of truth. So this sermon, the first sermon after his awakening to the five ascetics that he has practiced with, is considered a very, very important, very, very central topic in the study of Buddhism. It's considered that if there is any essential Buddhism, that's where it is, because he had just been awakened, actually with some weeks, because he sat for a week under one tree and then went and sat for a week under another tree. So there was actually some weeks, but this was his first time to really try to express fully what he awakened to. And usually, how do we explain that? How is it talked about? Well, first of all, I already mentioned the middle way is spoken of. He talked about neither indulging in sensuous pleasures nor denying yourself through asceticism. There is a middle way. I think almost all of you know this. This is very basic Buddhism. He also is said to have talked about the four noble truths. They probably weren't called that then, but they are now. The first noble truth is dukkha, that life is, I call it in dis-ease, not dis-ease, but dis-ease. We are not at ease when we reflect deeply on ourselves. There's something out of, there's something not in order. There's something not right. No matter how much we try to do good, we never fully get rid of evil. No matter how much we try to do something, we never are able really to do it fully. There's always something holding us back. That is ourself. But there's always something holding us back. And Shakyamuni describes this as being in dis-ease. It doesn't mean we're always suffering. The term is sometimes translated as suffering in Buddhist texts. That's not very satisfactory, because it sounds like very pessimistic, or you always got to be suffering if you're a Buddhist. No. What he's saying is there are pleasures, and he knew them very well as a young man. There are pleasures, but no matter how much you enjoy pleasures, you're never completely free of pain. They go together. When you are born, you are bringing death into the world with you. You will die. When you enjoy pleasures, enjoy them. But you will also enjoy some pain. They are relative things. If you do good, that doesn't mean you are completely free from evil, no matter how good you may try to be. Ask any saint, they know. So the first noble truth is that, as I call it, life is dis-ease. We are not, when we reflect deeply on ourselves, we are not at ease with ourselves. I guess that's why most of you are here today. That's why I went to Japan. The second noble truth is that there is a cause to this. It's translated sometimes as craving or as grasping. Because we have something, because we are something, we desire and we crave either to hold on to it, if we like it, or if we don't like it, to get rid of it. And it's a never-ending battle, because are we ever in a situation where everything is perfect? Hello, welcome to the real world, right? So there is always an underlying dis-ease. As long as we are trying to grasp or to be anything, to be something. So again, the first noble truth is that life for us, for the ordinary person, is dis-ease. The second basic noble truth is that there is a cause. And that cause is our own grasping or craving. You might say self-attachment. That's the cause. The third noble truth is the cutting off of the ceasing of the suffering itself, the ceasing of it. Not just, again, be careful, accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. It's not talking about that. It's talking about cutting the root completely. So the whole dualistic matrix of good and evil, of life and death, of being and non-being, not just trying to eliminate the negative. It's not, it doesn't work. It will never work. Shakyamuni realized that when he almost killed himself. So again, the entire matrix, the entire complex must be cut at the root. This is very clear in early Buddhism. That's the third noble truth. And the fourth noble truth, practically the way to do that. And that's usually spoken of as the Eightfold Noble Path. Right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right endeavor, right mindfulness, and right concentration. That much is pretty basic Buddhism. Glad you like that. But here, for this weekend, what we're trying to do is to sit in concentrated zazen, and to have as our focus, so to speak, if there is one, the fundamental koan, not this koan or that koan, a problem question given to a Zen student, a koan, but what's called the fundamental koan, the koan at the base of all koan. Expressed simply, as we are, however we are, will not do. Now, what do we do? That's the fundamental core. How do we work with this? Well, besides sitting in concentrated zazen, we'll also Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon have what's called mutual inquiry. Not having a teacher tell you that you have or have not achieved something, but together as equals, practicing and realizing this together, mutual. I prefer the term mutual self-inquiry, literally. Sogo Sankyu is the Japanese, for those who know Japanese. Literally, it means mutual inquiry, but for the Westerners, there's a tendency to think, okay, well, we get together and we mutually inquire. It's mutual self-inquiry. You're inquiring into the bottom of yourself with another. You're not inquiring into the other. You're inquiring into the bottom of yourself with another or with others. It could be unlimited. Okay, we understand maybe that much, but what does that have to do with Buddhism? It seems like a far cry from basic Buddhism, doesn't it? So let's go back one more time and take a look at early Buddhism and see if it's really so different. If we look again at Shakyamuni's life now, not as a legend or as someone 2,500 years ago, but as our own story, as humankind's story, it's the story of humanity, we can see that it's pointing out a very profound truth. He spoke of illness, aging, and death. That's the way they expressed it back then. But what he really was talking about is not limited to that. We can say it's the inevitable and the inescapable negativity, the limits of life. They're inevitable and they're inescapable. They're the negativity, the limitations of life. In a word, that dis-ease inherent in life, in being alive, in being something, in being anything. Well, what I did was I went back to the earliest sources I could find, because I said, if this is real, it's got to be there in some form or another. Maybe they don't talk in the same language, but it's got to be there. So I went back to what's called the Vinaya Pitaka. These are, they're usually understood as the basic precepts, how the rules for a monastic life came into being, right? But there are some very other, very interesting things in this Vinaya. For example, there's the story of Shakyamuni just after he awakened. And it's very much free from the later, especially the Mahayana kind of legends and supernatural stories where Buddha becomes really a god. So I think it's good to go back to this very early. This is considered very basic for Theravada, the earlier form of Buddhism, not Mahayana Buddhism, which Zen is associated with. So I'm leaping the bounds here, but it is the same thing indeed. Because if you look at the Vinaya, it very clearly says, when Shakyamuni awakened, he says, it was putting an end to this entire mass of dukkha, of disease, of suffering. Not some of it, or not the thing. Putting an end to the whole mass. That's the entire mass. That's the translator. He also spoke of it as crushing the great I am conceit. I am being something, being anything. Crushing the great I am conceit. And that he called supreme happiness. Also, interestingly enough, very soon after he awakened, before he even met those ascetics, he apparently met a kind of a roving ascetic who he had never met before. And this roving ascetic asked him some questions. Among the questions, according to the Vinaya Pitaka, is, who is your teacher? And Shakyamuni supposedly said, knowing for myself, who should I follow? For me, there is no teacher. He said it very clearly. That's why terms like self-awakening are used. He had two teachers, but he left them, and when he was under the Bodhi tree, he awakened on his own. He didn't awaken under... Who was Shakyamuni's teacher? It was his own true self. This is made clear in the Mutual Inquiry article, if any of you read that, by Hisamatsu. It's very clear in the early sutras. They also use the term solitary awakening without a teacher. That came to have a negative connotation in Japan, interestingly enough. But originally it was a very positive. It was used to describe Shakyamuni's awakening, because that was full Anyantarasam Yapsambodha. It was full, unconditioned, complete awakening. Without it, it couldn't have had a teacher. If it was a teacher, it would be conditioned. It was his own self-awakening. Look again at the middle way. In the Vinaya, it's very conservative in a sense, but it's interesting to see the way they describe the middle way. In all the English literature I see, the middle way between this and that. You'll never get there that way. And it says very clearly, it is the core way. It is not between indulgence and asceticism. It is freed from both sides. This quote is from a commentary on the Vinaya. It must be freed from both sides. That's why it is called the Madhyama, the middle. I would say core way. It's not the middle between, well, don't do it too hard, but don't do it too easy. No, it's the core way, freed from both of those extremes. That's the only way it can be Buddhism. That's the only way it can be awakening. Free from that entire dualistic matrix of good and evil, of life and death. Again, if you've read the other article that was suggested, the True Sitting piece by Hisamatsu, that's a kind of a conversation he had with people that they were sitting together in an FAS retreat like this, but it was in Kyoto some years ago. And he very clearly talks about that. It's not just getting free from good and evil. It must be getting free from all duality at the root. Otherwise, it's just an endless cycle. Again, cutting off the root is central in early Buddhism as well as, of course, in Zen. Again, that first sermon, again, I have never seen this explained. They say, the Buddhist scholars say constantly, that Shakyamuni explained to the five ascetics by means of the middle way, which I would say the core way. And that middle way, the first talk with the five ascetics, he used the concrete example of neither indulging in the senses nor a life of sheer asceticism. Neither way will do. They are both, as he often said, dead ends. But the Buddhist scholars have made such an absolute point of this middle way, what that means between these two. But why did he bring up those two examples in the first place? Did you ever wonder about that? It was perfectly natural, depending on the time and the place. When he met those five ascetics, they said, you did not awaken by practicing the asceticism that we did. How can you have awakened by indulging now? We saw you drinking milk and other things. They could not understand. You didn't do it through asceticism. And then even worse, you started indulging. From their point of view, you gave up the practice. How could you have awakened there? And again, in the Buddha Sutras often, they do this three times, asking, and then he gives a response. They're still not convinced. They ask again. And then he finally says, look, did you ever see me like this before? No, actually, we didn't. There's something happening here. So they said, you know, basically, shut up and let me explain this, okay? And then he used this metaphor. But if you look, the only reason he used all kinds of metaphors later on. The only reason he did it is because that's how the conversation was initiated. Those five ascetics were talking to him, and they said, well, wait a minute, we don't believe you. How could you be awakened? You didn't get awakened doing what we did, the asceticism. How could you do it by indulging? I mean, that seems such, you know, that seems going in the opposite direction. So he explained the middle way using that metaphor. It is neither indulging in the senses, nor is it mere asceticism. I did not go from one to the other. I finally went to core way. I broke through the very duality. But again, the tendency in Buddhism is to make those things absolute and to make these Buddhist teachings and principles. We use that example because that's what they were talking about. It's just like what the Zen masters do. They don't make some absolute principle. If you bring to them something, they'll discuss it in those terms. So I think we need to be careful about not making too many absolute principles out of Buddhism. The middle way is not too much this and not too much. It is the core way that breaks through the entire matrix. That's Buddhism. And it's very clear if you read the Vinaya Pitaka. Again, this is not Zen stuff. This is very far in terms of Buddhist scholarship from Zen stuff. This is very early, very conservative Theravada Buddhism. This is the basis for the precepts that the Theravada monks today still live by. So again, what I was trying to say is that he spoke about it in that way, not because his awakening was the middle way between these two things. That was the way the question was raised to him. So he responded that way. And then he tried to speak about it. We're not sure, but it's a legend. But in terms of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path, right? But these were ways that I suppose were perfectly natural at that time, 2,500 years ago in India, to talk about it, especially with those experienced ascetics. Why the Four Noble Truths? Let's think that one through a little bit more, because again, that seems very far from Zen Buddhism, doesn't it? What is it? The first noble truth is that life is dis-ease. Second noble truth is that there is a cause, that is craving to be or to have something. Well, look at the fundamental koan. What does the fundamental koan say? A little more precisely, maybe. As you are, however you are, will not do. Your being, anything as you are, will not do. It's saying the same thing. But it's, in a sense, it's making you realize that it's not making it an objective thing. Life is suffering. Life is dukkha. As you are, look at yourself. Can you come to rest as you are? Can you really, fully come to rest as you are? That's dukkha. It's the same thing. Then look at the third noble truth and the fourth noble truth. The third is cutting off the root of this. And the fourth is the way to do that, which is, again, the Eightfold Noble Path, right thought, right concentration, right livelihood. That sounds very far away, but this is no different from as I am, however I am, will not do. What do I do? It doesn't stop with as you are, will not do. Now, what do you do? You must be able to respond out of that. You must be able to awaken from it. That's what the third and the fourth noble truths are saying. What is the Eightfold Noble Path? Oh my God, books have been written. And they divided them up into different ways. You know what it is? It's every aspect of your life. That's all it is. The Eightfold Noble Path means every aspect of your life. That's what I think it meant 2,500 years ago in India. Especially for an ascetic life. Right concentration, right livelihood, right thought. It meant in every action, in every moment of your life. That's what the Eightfold Noble Path is. Carrying out that realization in every aspect of your life. That's what the Zen practice is all about too. It's the same thing. They don't speak about it that way usually. To put it even more bluntly, the Four Noble Truths are brought to life in Zazen. When you really do Zazen, it's not, okay, I'm working on the first noble truth. Yeah, I think I got that one. Okay, now let's move over to the second one. Right. No, they're all four of them are right there. All four of them in true Zazen, the Four Noble Truths are fully expressed. Not just the fact that as we are, will not do, that life is in dis-ease, but that there is a root and that you can dig that out by getting to the bottom of yourself. That's all Zazen is. There's nothing mystical about it at all. And when you do that, there is the Eightfold Noble Path, which is what? Carrying out in every moment, in every aspect of your life. When you think, when you act, in your livelihood. It's as simple as that. But let me make it even more simpler, okay? I think the most common, the most popular Zen koan in the history of, and there's a lot of them, is what? The wash your bowl one, right? We all know that one. We all think we understand it, right? How does it go? One of the great Chinese Zen masters about 1,200 years ago, in Japanese the name is pronounced Joshu. He's also known for the koan of Joshu's Mu, but this is another koan, that is an exchange that became a living problem. A monk new to Joshu's monastery came to Master Joshu, and he said to the master, "I have just arrived at your monastery. Please give me instruction." The master said, "Have you finished your morning meal yet?" The monk said, "Yes, I have." Joshu said, "Then wash your bowl." The monk had an insight. When I worked at a psychiatric hospital on Roosevelt Boulevard, in my orientation program, the head nurse used that same koan as an example of how we need to get the psychiatric patients back to ordinary life.
That's
good. But that's not the point of the story. That's not the point of the story. It's much deeper than that. So let's look a little bit more deeply at what just happened. Okay? All the master said was, "Did you finish your morning meal? Then wash your bowl." It's just perfectly natural, isn't it? If, then, right? And we do that all the time. But for us, it's a little bit different, isn't it? If I eat breakfast, and I got all those dishes, I got 10 minutes to go to work, and I got to wash them, or else they're all crusty when I get home. If I... That's dukkha. That's suffering. That's dis-ease. Right? So there's no magic about washing dishes. If you wash the dishes with a dirty mind, you're in dukkha. If you wash the dishes in a clean mind, or better yet, without a mind, that is freedom from all suffering. So what was the master really pointing to when he said that? It wasn't just, if you just take it as something about washing dishes, you've missed the point. Again, why didn't he use that example? Because it was morning when the guy came, and he knew with the bells that he had just finished breakfast. So it was the only thing to be asked. He didn't have to make anything up. That's why he used that example. I don't think he ever used it again. Joshu was known for being the light-emitting master. He was so eloquent. But he never used that teaching ever again that I know of. He said all kinds of other wonderful things. But you have to see why he said that at that situation. Because the monk, I don't know, maybe he had a little bit of rice on his chin or something. He said, "Well, yeah, you just finished your meal, didn't you? Well, then go wash your bowl." That was what needed to be done at that time. Let me put it this way. From where was Joshu, the master, speaking when he said, "Have you finished your meal? Then wash your bowl"? He wasn't speaking from the ordinary logical point of view, right? If, oh, okay, then no. I would put it this way. There was not a hair's breadth between "have you finished your meal" and "then wash your bowl." There was not a hair's breadth between them. And the monk was able to see that. He was an experienced monk. He was new to that monastery, but he wasn't a new monk, I don't think. All the Rinzai texts make a point of saying, this monk was new to that monastery, but he wasn't a new monk. Because if he had an insight from this, he was ripe already. Let me try to explain it in another way. If we look at a human being, a little baby is living a life, basically, of senses. When it's thirsty, when it's hungry, what does it do? It cries because it's thirsty. I mean, it doesn't have to think, "Because I'm thirsty," right? "If I'm thirsty, I'll cry." I don't think little babies do that. When they're thirsty, they cry. When they're fed, maybe they smile and they fall asleep. It's a kind of a sensuous life. But what happened to all of us as we grew up? As we grew up, we gradually learned to develop into rational, reasoning beings. Simple example, "Well, I really want that drink, but that's not mine, so I better not take it. I better order my own." Right? We develop as rational, reasoning animals. We can't do it when we're 1 year old, but it does happen gradually as we grow older. Did anyone teach you to be rational? You may remember an experience when a parent or a teacher or something said something, it really ticked. But really, wasn't it an awakening from within? Maybe it was gradual over time, but it can't be something that someone teaches you. It has to be something that you gradually realize that you awaken to, and then you become a rational being. You don't simply deal with the senses anymore. In a sense, it's a growth. I mean, we all want to do this. There's a lot of negative statements about, you know, being too rational, but we don't want to just live as small infants all our lives either, right? So in a sense, it's a kind of a progress, developing as humans, developing reason. The great problem is that we think that that is the end of life, to develop reason and to develop even better, right? Science, technology, that's all the development of that. And when I say reason, I don't just mean intellectual. I mean our emotions and our will are ruled by reason as well. Our very attempt to be emotional is not free from reason. We are never totally free from reason, in a sense. Even when we try to be spontaneous, we are fully rational animals. I'm not just talking about the intellectual element of our life. Our will and our emotion is itself, in a sense, ruled, limited by reason. The problem is, again, that we normally think, well, that's the way it is. That's human, that's life. That's what man and woman is all about. Well, if you look at the basic teachings of Buddhism, it denies that. The basic teaching of Buddhism is that is not the end of life. The basic teaching of Buddhism is that there is an awakening which goes beyond reason. It's not simply denying reason or the senses, nor belittling them, but in a sense it's going beyond the limits of reason. It's breaking through the very duality, as I spoke about earlier. That's what awakening is. And again, awakening to reason, people can help you with that. Piaget, interesting child psychologist, talked about the development of this. But really it's something, finally, you have to just awaken to yourself. Well, I hate to say it, but awakening and, you know, religious awakening is the same thing. We can help each other, we can do a great deal to help, but the awakening can only come from out of yourself. And it is through breaking through the limits of reason. And it's important not to see that just as denying, now I'm not going to be rational anymore. Well, that's just another rational play, isn't it? That's not a solution to anything, right? So genuine Buddhist awakening must reveal the self that is at the bottom, the formless self, the self that is not anything, but is able to use everything freely. So it is able to reason. Look at Joshua. He was reasoning, wasn't he? Did you finish your breakfast yet? Then, sounds pretty logical to me, but it wasn't. Where was Joshua speaking from when I said there wasn't a hair's breadth between have you finished your morning meal? Then wash your bowl. That wasn't a rational judgment. It can be seen that way, but you have to see where he was coming from. And the monk was able to see that. That's why in the text, this is from the Mumonkan, the Gateless Barrier Zen text, it said, it's also in the record of Joshua, it says, the monk had an insight. He wasn't awakened, but he had a deep insight, probably he bowed. What did he realize? What did the monk realize? I would put it this way. He was able to see that Joshua was answering from a place completely different from where he was. But again, don't forget his question. He was not a novice monk. I have come, maybe he, you know, going to Joshua's monastery is not an easy thing 1,200 years ago, right? First of all, he probably had his head shaved, became a monk, left his family, went through other practice, climbed up this mountain, and now he finally gets to meet the legendary Joshu, the great master. So, this is his chance. He says, I am new to your monastery. I came here all the way. Please give me your instruction. Teach me. Help me. He knows. As I am, it will not do. What do you think he became a monk for? For fun? He knows that as he is, it will not do. So he's coming and begging the master to give him instruction. What did the master say? He simply turned to him. He didn't teach him anything, did he? He said, "You finished breakfast? Why don't you wash your dishes?" He didn't teach him anything. He simply returned him to himself. Returned him to himself before reason even had a moment to come up. The monk was able to reason about it, but when he saw Joshu say that, he saw where Joshu was coming from. So he had an insight. Probably he also saw where he was coming from, and that, in a sense, it was a mistake to even ask the master that question. To put it more bluntly, the master might have said, "What are you coming after me for? When you finish eating, you wash your bowl. When it's time to die, you lay down and die. What's the problem?" The monk couldn't fully get it, but it did say he had an insight. He probably died. The monk already knew, I think, that being something would not do, but he didn't know what to do about it, so he was begging the teacher for instruction. But again, he wasn't just saying, "Oh, okay, so you wash the bowl." No, it was something like he was speaking from somewhere beyond reason. Even if it looks like a rational statement, this was not an if-then statement of the ordinary order. And it's clear if the monk had an insight from it. I think that's the simplest koan there is. I mean, really all of them are simple, but some are more complex, more complicated. But I think that's the most popular and the simplest on the surface level. But just like any real koan, there is an infinite depth to it. Again, what I think Joshu was pointing to, and he wasn't giving a teaching, he was simply pointing it out to the monk with, "You finished your meal? Wash your bowl." He was pointing to what was right here and now at the moment, and that it was free from all suffering. Maybe not from the monk's side yet, but he could get a feeling. It was certainly an inspiration for him. But also he was showing him, in a sense, why are you even asking me? Right? He's not saying, "Oh, and by the way, come back at 8 o'clock and I'll teach you about Dzogchen." No. He said, "Are you finished eating? Then wash your bowls. It's all right there. If you can do that completely, there it is. There it is." Well, this is the greatness of Zen Buddhism. Again, that awakening is available here and now. That's why those kinds of examples are so gripping. Wash your bowls. Oh, that's right. You always, "Oh, that's right. It is right there, isn't it?" Like, if it's really right there, it's right here everywhere. The Eightfold Noble Path. In every aspect of our life. It's always available to us. It's just a matter of awakening to it. That's what Zazen is all about. That's what a retreat like this is all about. That's what practicing together is all about. If you look again at Zazen, what is Zazen? It's the classic posture of self-awakening. You're not looking for outside for anything. As Ron explained, you're looking outside, but you're not looking outside for anything. You're not trying to find a mandala or anything. You're allowing your eyes naturally to focus about a meter ahead of you, but your focus is not there. You see? That's what it means that Zazen itself is self-awakening. How can you seek out a teacher in Zazen? You've got your legs folded up. You are the teacher. You have to become the teacher. That's what Zazen is all about. And again, this strange fundamental koan. Is it really so strange? As you are, however you are, will not do. Now what do you do? As you are, however you are, will not do. It's simply pointing out, look, the problem is in yourself. It is yourself. Now, what do you do? And they don't mean go to a teacher. They mean, what do you do? Why? Because the answer, I shouldn't say the answer because it's not an answer, but the ceasing of the problem is also yourself, in yourself. When you finally let go of everything, that is the answer. And that is completely without form. That's why it is able to be the Eightfold Noble Path in every aspect of our life. I mean, cursing, pissing, being angry doesn't mean always blissful. No. If you've really awakened, it's there in every moment. It must be there in every moment. That's what the Eightfold Noble Path is about. Once again, mutual inquiry. I want to have a Zen master. What is this mutual inquiry stuff? Well, it's trying to show you that in getting to the bottom of yourself with another, and of course it can be done at any time or any place. We don't have to set aside 2 hours in the afternoon for it. But it helps in the beginning especially to do that. But that's all we're doing. We are getting to the bottom of ourselves with another person. And it's a very precious opportunity. It is mutual. Nobody's teaching anyone else. Why? Because no one has to teach anyone else. If you just awaken to it for yourself, and no one can teach you that anyway. The real awakening, there can be some help, there can be some provocation, but no one can awaken you. No one can awaken you. No one needs to awaken you. That's the wonder of Buddhism, which means Buddha, and awakened one, which means you. I also found a very interesting expression in the Vinaya, the commentary on the Vinaya. Again, this is going all the way back to those precepts, this Theravada stuff. There's an expression in Pali, Sambodho ki mago, literally awakening. Sambodhi, Sanskrit, is marga, mago, the way. Awakening is the way. This is in the context of the Eightfold Noble Path. What is the way? Right understanding, right thought. What is the seventh one now? I can never remember all eight of them, but that's okay. Awakening is the way. It's very clear in the commentary on the Vinaya Pitaka. It's all right, all of the Eightfold Noble Path is there. And if you dig a little bit deeper with those five ascetics, it's very interesting what you find. We're going to do mutual inquiry. What do you think those five ascetics were doing? They didn't call it that, but look a little more deeply at what was going on, according again to the Vinaya Pitaka. The Theravada text, it says, Shakyamuni then spoke with the five ascetics. This wasn't just, okay, now I'm going to tell you some story. No, they were going through it as they were talking, right? These were experienced people, as we all are, experienced in life. It wasn't just talk. There's this stuff, suffering. No, it was, that's what it is. Okay, now look. Look, where does it come from, right? And according to the legend, within a little while, within a very short period, one of those arhat, one of those ascetics, awakened by himself. It says it in the text. Shakyamuni was talking to him, but he was awakened by himself, quote, without another's help. Of course not. He couldn't do it with another self. But it even says that in the text. Then another one got awakened. Now there were two of them. What did they do? They went out begging to get food for the other three that weren't yet awakened. Also a very valuable practice. Maybe they remembered to wash their bowls too. But anyway, they went out and did something. Meanwhile, Shakyamuni continued in practice, in dialogue as well, with the remaining three, a third one, fourth one. Then finally, all five of them, the ascetics, awakened, as it says, on their own without another's help. They realized themselves. Shakyamuni was initiating something, but the awakening was not from Shakyamuni. They awakened by themselves. And the end of that section is called the Mahavaga, the great section of the Vinaya Pitaka. It says two very illuminating things. The first one is, now we are no more such and such. That's the translation. But if you go back to the Pali, we no more are of form. We no more are anything. And we are aware that we are not anything. In everything that we do, we are completely free of form. That is what awakening is. And then the very last sentence, the end of this entire section of the Mahavagga says, quote, now there were six, aha, count them, six. Eight little, seven little, six little Indians. Who were the six arhats? Arhats is an enlightened one, an awakened one. Who were they? Who were the six? The five ascetics and Shakyamuni. They were perfectly equal at this point in time. As the sutras went on, of course, they weren't. But this is in the Vinaya Pitaka. Now there were six arhats. There were six awakened people. And they all got awakened with each other in a sense, but they awakened by themselves. The help in a sense was secondary. The awakening was what was fundamental. Now there were six arhats. Very suggestive, I think. Not five arhats and the man. No, there were six arhats. They were completely equal. This is very important to remember in Buddhism. Let me give one more. It's almost 8:30, so I'll stop in a few minutes. But one more good example of this again. And now, again, I will go back to early Theravada sources to illuminate Zen practice, because it's got to be there. I knew it was there, and I looked, and it didn't take very long to find it. This is from the Mahaparinibbana Sutra in Pali, or Parinirvana Sutra in Sanskrit. It's the Sutra of the Great Death, when Shakyamuni passes away, right? Probably the most famous statement of Shakyamuni, which is, right, be lamps unto yourselves, be a refuge unto yourselves. Have no external refuge. Hold fast to truth as a lamp. Look not to anyone beside yourselves. I'm not making this up. This is Shakyamuni at the end of his life, trying to give the pith of his teaching. Ananda, one of his leading disciples, asked Shakyamuni when it was clear that he was dying, can you give us someone to lead the community, the Sangha? Because you're going to pass away soon, right? So can you authorize someone, right? Basically, that's what he was saying. Do you know what Shakyamuni said? Well, in later legends in the Zen, yeah, Mahakashapa, right? No, he didn't say that. Again, according to the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, he said, Ananda, I have never thought of myself as leading the Sangha community. Why should I choose someone? If someone wants to lead this community, then let them. But, and again, I have never thought of myself as leading the Sangha community. Because he didn't have to. We all do it. What were his last words? Again, these are maybe the second most famous. Supposedly his dying words were, all things pass away, all conditioned things, which in India, that kind of course meant everything. All conditioned things pass away. Work out your salvation, literally awaken with diligence. It's very illuminating for this weekend, isn't it? Well, finally, you might say, okay, but how do we really put this into practice? You know, we want to make this concrete. Well, I can really give the concrete details tomorrow morning, but at least for those who are just here for the lecture. Initially, it's quite difficult. Initially, it's quite difficult. And I know, I went through hell the first 5 or 6 years in Japan. It was hell. Initially, it's very difficult. Why is it so difficult? It's not difficult. The difficulty is not there. It's here. It's because we are so used to being something, to grasping on or denying something. And neither way will do. Neither way will be an entrance into Buddhism. It's as simple as that. We are not used to it. It's not difficult. It's just that we've spent our whole lives endlessly seeking in the wrong way. We've endlessly gone out of ourselves to try to grab something with form that can pacify it. And of course, it doesn't work. So we throw that away disgusted. Never was any good anyway. And we go for something else, whether it be another relationship or another car or another occupation or another degree or whatever. But we never really come to rest, do we? But again, it's not difficult at all. There's nothing easier. You don't have to do anything. That's what's so hard. But that's what Zazen is all about. Learning simply to be without being anything, without taking anything. You're so used to already becoming something. We're so used to grasping onto ourselves and others as something already with form. So when the Zen master says, okay, where does that form come from? We're at a loss. But that's a very important question, because unless we can really penetrate that, we're endlessly involved in a vicious circle. There's nothing easier than getting out of it, but it does take some training. It does take some discipline, because we're not used to it. That's what concentrated Zazen is all about. That's what a retreat is all about. To practice this in every aspect of our lives. It's so easy to grasp on to something, even the Buddha or the patriarch, without grasping on to anything. What are you? Who are you? Show me who you are before you became anything. Before you could say, I, who were you? That's who it is. That's who you are. And that self does not suffer. Or it suffers without suffering, if you want to put it that way. It's not a problem. Concentrated Zazen is getting to the bottom of ourselves and realizing what's really there, which means what's really here. It's not possible to fully comprehend awakening in terms of dualistic reason and logic. Dualistically, we know that, but dualistically, we try to do it anyway, don't we? You cannot fully grasp awakening through logic or reason. It doesn't work, okay? The metaphor doesn't work. I often speak, I speak about it, but it's basically, yes, Buddha means an awakened one. It means to wake up from the dream. When you wake up, you can't use the metaphor of the dream to explain waking up. When you wake up, all of the dreams, the mountains and the rivers and the monster chasing you, and you yourself in the dream, when you wake up, where are they? They're all gone without remainder. And yet everything is here, really here now, for the first time in all its clarity. So don't try to use the metaphor in sleep for what it's like to wake up. It just doesn't work. The problem, though, is then you think, okay, well then we're going to transcend reason. We're going to attain something out there. Impossible. Impossible. You can try if you want. Try till your belly hits your backbone. I do. Doesn't work. Doesn't work. It doesn't work. Whatever you do will not do. As long as it's you doing it, it will not work. Rather than trying to transcend it, you return to the origin. That's where it is. It's always right here and right now, right under your feet, as they say in Zen. That's why they use that. So, such a concrete metaphor. Look under your feet. It's always right there. Don't look at it as something transcendent, as something to be attained. There is nothing to attain. And when you really come home to that, that is awakening. And there is no need to attain anything now. You only seek to attain something because you're still locked in with reason and with logic. You can't gain awakening from another. But you don't need to. That's the wonderful thing. You don't need to. We all have everything we need. And yet, at the same time, we can and we do help each other along the way. That's the point of having a retreat. We can't awaken the other, but we can help to spur each other on. As a matter of fact, finally, I would say I am completely dispensable, not indispensable, dispensable. I'm the least necessary person here, as it should be. Why did I bother coming over here? I arrived Wednesday night, midnight, Thursday morning, so like a day and a half ago, still getting over jet lag. Why did I do that? Because I had some precious teaching to teach you. I have nothing. I have nothing whatever. I came because I am the most deluded one of all. And I have been asked to speak, so I do. Because I am the most deluded one of all, I'm the perfect example. If someone like me can realize it, then for sure anyone can realize it. It is available to anyone, to everyone. And when I say that, I don't mean if then. I don't mean if then. I mean it is available to everyone. We can be some small help to each other. And doing these things is also a precious practice for me. I always learn a great deal. When the conditions are right, we naturally awaken. Just when conditions are right, the sensuous little baby starts to develop reason. It happens. Things can be done, Piaget talked, to kind of help bring that along. That's what a retreat, very well thought out, is all about. How to provide the optimal conditions and to practice together to promote this awakening together as a group. It's perfectly natural. I won't even call it Buddhism. I know an awakened one, that's what Buddha means, but I see no reason to limit to Buddhism. What I'm talking about is humanity, the depth of being human. That's what I'm talking about. If almost everyone or many, many people were awakened, there would be no need for the Buddhist religion. The Buddhist religion is just a secondary thing, you know. It is for people who are stuck. If people get unstuck, then you can throw Buddhism right out the window. There's nothing absolute about Buddhism. Shakyamuni never said it was absolute. But he saw the suffering in the world and he did what he could to help others awaken. That's what we do here. So, at the very end, I'm left with the unenviable position of explaining what FAS is. I left that to the end because it's easy, but if you don't have a context for it, it can sound silly. Japanese like acronyms. And they chose this one, Hikamatsu, the inspiration for the FAS Society. Actually, after touring the States in 57 to 58, when he met Dr. Stunkard, he's not here yet, huh? But he will come. F, in a word, is formless self-awakening. That's the basis of Buddhism, awakening to our true, to our formless self. That's what F is, formless self-awakening. Okay? That's the basis of Buddhism. The problem that Hisamatsu felt was A and S were lacking. There was so much stress on awakening in Buddhism that it never went out of the monastery walls. So he promoted A, all humankind. In other words, once you awaken, where do you stand? As a Japanese Rinzai Buddhist or even as a Buddhist? If you're really awakened, you don't even have to stand as a Buddhist. You stand as all humanity, with and as all beings. That is it. That is all humankind. And the S is even harder. Supra historical history. I'm sorry, but the Japanese like this kind of stuff. It's in English, but supra historical history. What that means is you transcend history. In a very real sense, when you awaken, you transcend all of created history, everything that has been made. But you don't go out. You transcend created history and then you create truth. true, formulate history from there. You act. What do? You function. You must work in the world. Respond to the suffering. That's what S is about. So transcending history in the sense of not simply coming out of what has already been made, but creating it at each and every moment. That's what living awakening is. At every moment, it is always completely new. That's where history is. History is not something that was made in the past or will be made in the future. History is being made by each and every one of us at each and every moment, if we're awake to it. And that history is really free from suffering. That's true human history. Kisamatsu is very interested in history, unlike most Zen masters. To give a very simple problem, look at the caste system. Apparently Shakyamuni realized the falseness of the caste system. And he said, if you are of the highest caste, but you are deluded by your senses, you are of the lowest caste. And you, if you are of the lowest caste, if you are free from sensuousness, if you are awake to your true self, you are of the highest caste. He completely revolutionized the caste system, which, by the way, is still a problem today. Just in the newspaper a few weeks ago, a bunch of Indians from one caste were murdered by ones from another caste in the countryside. And it's still a problem. It's not resolved yet. And yet, look at the insight of Shakyamuni in that particular problem. He was able to see through to true humanity so deeply that he could say, look that person in the eye and say, I don't care what caste you're from. This community, this was revolutionary at 2,500 years ago. This community is open to anyone. To anyone, not limited to caste. And if you are of the lowest caste, but you realize yourself, as far as I'm concerned, you are of the highest caste. That was revolutionary. That's what S is about. That's a very simple, concrete example of it. I can talk more tomorrow morning about what the fundamental koan is and what mutual inquiry is for those that will be here, but let me stop now so we have some time for questions, whatever. Okay?